welcome to Reclaiming the Republic. This show is sponsored by ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. I am G.R. Mobley. This is an educational grassroots program focused on uniting and leading in restoring the Republic and placing the federal government back into the scope and framework of the Constitution once again.
And welcome back. And it is now or never. And that debt is fraud. And as we kind of go through these obligatories, as we make our appeals to heaven, we need to continue to learn, pray, and act. And I tell you what, I'm still learning. And today's show, I'm going to whip out some stuff we've learned, or actually through due diligence, we've been able to uncover the beginning of the details of how Congress chose to break through the Constitution. We know how the judiciary broke through the Constitution. And so the president, that's a little bit different. But anyway, because typically the president, in many cases, either utilized or had Congress and or the judiciary kind of, I'll just say, endorse or allow the presidential's actions, the president's unconstitutional actions. So anyway, as we move forward, it's all about focusing on the Constitution. And what I mean by that, folks, is I mean fully focused on the Constitution, full compliance. In other words, we don't want to just focus on a line, a clause, a small part of, as most of the patriot groups do. They're misleading you. Every time you focus on a particular line in the Constitution, now, it's one thing to use that focus to learn specifically, because we're going to dive into Article 4 today, Article 4, Section 3. And so it's important to kind of understand all of them and do deep dives, that's okay. However, when you strictly focus and the only thing you promote is the Second Amendment, then you are a huge part of the problem, because you're getting everybody else to turn their backs on the rest of the Constitution that is being trampled upon. You see my point? This, not that the Second Amendment needs to be thrown out. The Second Amendment is not the only thing. Every organization out there that uses myopic focus on a particular agenda, they are the problem. As far as patriots go, because all they're doing is trying to mislead you into thinking, oh, well, this is the most important thing. At least I feel like this is the most important thing. Whether that be abortion, whether that be a convention of states, a convention of counties, they're all misleading you. That's the danger of getting people to misplace their focus and start focusing on the little shiny object that they want to shine in front of you, or rattle in front of you, whatever. And that gets you to lose sight of the big picture and why we're in this problem and why we all need to focus on full compliance to the Constitution. So, all right, Section 3 of Article 4. Let's pick this apart, because this is admitting new states into the Union. Now, Congress does not have the power to create states and give them a purpose, a role, you know, an appointing states to a particular status. What it says here is new states may be admitted by Congress into this union. Now, what is a state? As the Treaty of Paris basically laid out, all states are independent and sovereign. When they created this Constitution, all states are independent and sovereign. As a matter of fact, let's not forget that Congress was devised in, or basically separated into, two separate representative bodies. One that represented the people of the states, so that they would have their representation as people. And in the other house, it was the Senate, where the states had their independent and equal suffrage, their equal sovereignty, to ensure that one state with more population couldn't railroad the rest of the states. Protecting state sovereignty was ingrained within the Constitution because of that fact right there, because of Article 5, absolutely protecting the state's equal suffrage in the Senate. making it impossible for that to be changed via an amendment. That's what the Amendment Protection Clause was for. So Congress doesn't have the power to appoint and ordain and create states to serve, to serve the Union in a specific purpose. All states joining the Union are independent and sovereign states. Okay, so it basically says new states may be admitted by the Congress. Now, the one thing you take away from that is it's not from the executive. It is not going to be from the judiciary. It can only be from Congress. In other words, Congress has the responsibility and the stewardship to prepare and assist states in becoming sovereign states and parties to the compact. Because when a state joins the Union, they become an equal party to the compact. When an amendment comes through, they have equal say whether that amendment is going to be ratified or not. And they have equal say in all things. So, new states may be admitted by the Congress into this Union. That's it. That's the whole point of Article 4, Section 3. Now, the rest of this first paragraph, or if you want to call it a section, they didn't identify it as a section or subsection, says, but no new state shall be formed or erected within the jurisdiction of another state, nor any state be formed by the junction of two or more states or parts of states. In other words, they're basically qualifying what it's going to take for a state to join the Union. If it's going to be formed out of a state or a junction of states, then it says that can't happen without the consent of the legislatures of the states concerned as well as of Congress. Or well of the Congress, as well as of the Congress. So, so to be clear, a new state can join the Union as long as it is not being formed within the jurisdiction of another state. If it's an independent territory that is not, it may be neighboring a state, it may be right on the border of a state, but if it's not adjoined to that state or within that state, then only Congress has the say. Now, I could imagine that there were probably a couple of states in the Union that other states were going, no, don't let these guys in. Don't let them in, like Utah. But that being said, Congress had the full say, not the judiciary. So new states can be admitted, and these are the parameters of, whether they can be admitted or not without, by their own, or I should say, on their own accord, or whether they would require the blessing and or approval. So when we look at the first three states that joined the Union, they required an initial state such as, and I haven't dove into it, so it's either going to be New York or New Hampshire that basically sanctioned or blessed Vermont into joining the Union, because it was considered a territory, just like Maine was a territory of New Hampshire, just like Kentucky was a territory of Virginia, and just like Tennessee was a territory of North Carolina, and just like Alabama and Mississippi were, and I think maybe a part of Louisiana, maybe, were a part of the territory, or I should say the state of Georgia. So these states may have been and should have been consulted, because in the beginning of the formation of this new Union under the Constitution, those states had claims and or had territory adjoining them. And so that territory was not going to be expanded as a state. That territory was going to be used to create a new state. In other words, they weren't going to just continue to go with the Confederation and the paradigm or the model that they had under the king, where these large colonies would expand all the way across the United States. So the design was that all new territories or existing territories were basically going to be prepared and transitioned into states. That was the whole purpose of acquiring land. The strategic idea was to basically create states from Atlantic all the way to the Pacific. Now, I don't think that that was written down as a strategic plan, probably until the, not the Monroe, maybe the Monroe Doctrine, because the Monroe Doctrine kind of fed the manifest destiny concept. But all that being said, the second paragraph is where everybody starts perverting states joining the Union, because it says here, the Congress shall have power to dispose of and make all needful rules and regulations respecting the territory or other property belonging to the United States. So in other words, if there's a bank, which is a building, a needful building, then the United States or Congress shall be able to establish the rules and regulations regarding that building, regarding that fort, regarding that shipyard. If it is a piece of property purchased by the federal government by the consent of that state legislature where that federal property exists. Now, when we see territory, and we're looking at a territory, that is not federal property. That is union property, where the federal government has the stewardship of protecting and transitioning into statehood. Unless their position is that it was, you know, sometimes companies and or nations will go out and acquire land, and they will basically kind of use that land as leverage because they may want land from somebody else. You know, they look and they say, you know what, this company has a business that we really want. And so we're going to go buy a couple of businesses that we know that those guys would like, but they don't have the money at this point to buy them because they're, you know, stretched a little too thin. So what we're going to do is we're going to buy these companies or this company, and we're going to offer a trade and make an equitable deal so that we can have what we want, they can have what they want. As we looked at the expanse of America, there were opportunities to go north and south, and definitely there was plenty of opportunity to go west. And as we traveled west, we had to deal with both north and south. And so that's why the Louisiana Territory became a purchase, and it became the opportunity of a lifetime. And then down the road, we started acquiring more land. We started buying land from Mexico, which took us down to Texas and all the way across to California, and in the Northwest, outside of the Louisiana Territory, there was property and land that Britain had that we didn't like the idea that they had them. We started staking claim. And well before 1849, let's see, it was about 1845, 1847, 48, something like that, where we completely galvanized the entire contiguous 48 states. Completely. In other words, we now had claim, hard claim, that this was our territory going from the Atlantic all the way to Washington State of the Pacific down to California, San Diego border of the Pacific as well. So we had all of the land that we see today as our 48 contiguous states. Prior to the establishment, the permanent creation of the Department of Home. And that right there was a big, huge warning sign that the federal government was operating well beyond its bounds, and it had every intent to basically pervert and subvert the Constitution against the states so that the federal government could basically subjugate the states. So as we dive into this, now this whole point that I just read, the Congress shall have the power to dispose of land. Like I said, they could exchange it. If it's a territory, it could be exchanged. And the needful rules and regulations respecting the territory. So why would they need to make needful rules? Well, as they started organizing, they had to assist these new people coming in, and each territory was going to be different. It's not like James Madison, Rufus King, all of these framers went from one state to the next state, or one area of a territory to another territory to another territory, in preparing all of these territories to transition into statehood. That would be, well, it would have been great if they'd done that, because I think they would have done it right. I think that these men having, you know, this profound understanding of what needed to be done as they started moving west, they would have done it more and more correctly. And that would have bogged down Congress's ability to get out of check. Now, the final part of this is really, really important. Nothing in this Constitution book shall be so construed as to prejudice any claims of the United States or of any particular state. So in other words, when a state joins the Union, the United States can't make a claim that would prejudice the claim of that state. When that state becomes a state, it literally has the sovereignty over all of its land. In other words, if the federal government created a territory or a reservation within a state, and that state, or within the territory, and that state or territory transitioned into a state, that land then gets turned over to that state because the United States government cannot prejudice those claims to say, oh, well, we created a treaty. Well, hold on here. You don't have a treaty authority to actually use my land for some other purpose. It would be antithetical to the purpose of the federal government's job, its foremost priority in protecting the sovereignty of a state, the sovereignty of the Union, the sovereignty of the state, and the sovereignty of the people. That is their primary job. So as we look at this responsibility, now we're going to look into the initial conversations of the Western land, parts of the Union that had not been established as a state. The reason why we're doing this is as we dive into the very first conversation. See, Congress started meeting in, you know, the spring of 1789, and they had a laundry list of things that they needed to do. And so they had topics that they talked about. And I could probably pull up all the different topics, but as I look at it, and let me do that real quick. Let me do that really, really quick. So probably the first topic that came up, and you'll find this in the congressional records around page 107, where Congress started talking as far as topics. What do you think their most important topic that they wanted to talk about? Taxes. That's right, taxes and duties and so forth. So from 107 through, I'll just say, we can go down to 200, through the 200s. Yeah, down to about 241, the president speaks, and then they get back to tonnage, and they talk more and more. And then there's some other little ancillary things, but we're talking about very minor, like one page worth of, you know, the president or the president making a speech or Congress answering the president. And so the manner of taking oaths was a one-day thing. So predominantly, if you look at the pages, the voluminous pages of the first couple hundred pages, it was covering either duties and or duties on tonnage or imposts or what have you. And so as we look at the 400-page series, this is where, and actually it's around 300 at the, towards the 383, you'll find they start talking about the executive department, then they go into the treasury, and then they go into some other little ancillary things, contested election, then they go into some duties on tonnage, and then boom, 427, page 427. I'm going to be posting these all kind of comprehensive, but it's unfortunate that I'm going to have multiple different sets because I could give you a 500-page pile of paperwork to go through so that you'd have to turn to page 427 and then read that through 441. And then if you want to go into the amendments, you can do that. But, you know, creating the topics, I mean, it's a lot of work for somebody to kind of turn the page. And what I want to do is just give it to you in a lump. In other words, the very first session of Congress, and we've got half of it done now. The very first session, we don't have anything compiled yet. So, but when it's all done and compiled, so I'm confident that by the time I'm done reading these sections that I picked out, I will have everything compiled for that very first section, possibly even working on the second session. In other words, the second 2 years, 1789, 1790, 1791, 1792. And in 92 is when Washington was being elected again. And so We're going to dive into Western lands very specifically, because this is where they basically laid out what they were going to do, and then down the road, they changed that. I say that because I don't believe that they said, hey, you know, while they're keeping record, they're going to say, hey, you know, I think that this is going to be a real opportunity for us to subjugate and actually basically diminish the sovereignty of states to a point that by the time the latest states come into the union, they won't have sovereignty, and we will drag the rest of the states down with those states so that we now will be the boss and controlling all. I believe the men in these initial sessions really had that, the moral integrity and the focus on trying to do things right. So there's an advantage of doing this. So let me dive into page 427. And actually, I have not dove into this. On Monday last week, a week ago, I started in the 690s, I think. So I realized, you know what, let me go check. And sure enough, there was this part. So there's these few parts that are ahead of what we already wrote, what we already read. So I'm not going to say forget it, because we're going to repeat it again. But we're going to go through these. Why is this so important? Because when Congress tried to create the Department of Transportation, Madison wouldn't let them do it. When they went to Monroe and said, let us have a Department of Transportation, Monroe wouldn't do it. Then they even went to Jackson and they go, you know what, I can't let you do that because these other two presidents have said so. So if the people want us to have this, then let's do it. By the time they got to Jackson, they were already playing this Ponzi scheme where they were establishing roads without the authority. Now, I don't think Jackson even batted an eye regarding what Congress had assumed these powers to be, because Jackson was well at work on his own in changing how the president could actually start manipulating the face of government. He was the guy that started firing everybody and hiring all of his friends to basically start putting money in his friends' pockets so that they would have cash to help invigorate more Democratic wins. You understand what I just said? It was the Democrats, the first Democrat, Jackson, that actually started using the spoil system to start throwing the tax dollars around and putting them into tax, you know, Democrat loyalists to ensure the Democrats were going to become the prevailing party of the future, which it did for a while. There were a lot of different parties that challenged them, but nobody was even caring. Now, at this point in time, as long as they weren't busting down your door, as long as people really didn't feel the threat, the federal government started getting away with doing all of these little encroachments. So it starts off on page 427. And this is Western lands. The House on motion of Mr. Scott went into committee of the whole on the State of the Union for the purpose of considering certain resolutions he had prepared respecting the disposal of the land in the Western Territory. Mr. Trumbull in the chair. Now, the disposal in the land, this is basically talking about what are we going to do with that? Mr. Scott presumed there was little need of an argument to prove the committee the necessity of taking speedy measures with respect to the unsettled lands in the Western Territory. The dissolution of the Board of Treasury and the death of the late geographer of the United States are adventitious circumstances which tend to increase the necessity. Gentlemen are acquainted with the number of sales which have been made to some of the citizens of the United States. They consequently know that, and I got to go all the way up to the top, that the United States are under an obligation to complete the surveys of those lands which they have made sale of. They know also, now we're going into break, so we'll pick it up right there. They know also when we come back. Now, I'm reading this so that you can kind of read along, because as we read, we're going to actually understand what we're reading. We're going to see everything that is critical. So when we come back, we will dive back into this. And I think things are going to fall into place as we do this regarding how the federal government punched through. We'll be right back after this.
If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review as well as my description of the republic review model on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how republic review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you. As a reminder, if you have any questions or comments, we have a 24-hour comment line, 425-270-5416. Okay, so let me get back into this. They know also that until this is done, they cannot receive a farthing, a farthing of the millions of dollars due on those contracts. They will not only be unable to receive principal, but will be paying interest for the same. In other words, if the United States purchased that territory, and I don't understand the circumstances, especially regarding the Northwest, because at this point in time, the only territory, and I think the Northwest Ordinance or the Northwest Territory possibly was purchased and ceded by Britain, because we made claims to that. And as a part of the Paris Treaty, they recognized that that land would be ours because that's, we had presence there. And so the real problem with the treaty, because we talked about this, that was one of the things that they didn't honor because they didn't get out. They were maintaining nefarious relationships with the Indians and so forth. So anyway, they will not only be unable to receive the principal, but will be paying the interest for the same, for paying for that land. Now, that may have been something that the United States was paying Britain for because we made that claim. And so because Britain had that claim, they basically say, okay, well, you can have it for this much. I don't know. I don't remember seeing that in the Treaty of Versailles. So it may have been something that happened before. Anyway, besides this, there are other considerations for putting the business on a new footing. The mode hitherto pursued of selling land has been very expensive to the United States. Perhaps on inquiry, we can find that the species it has cost us in getting the land surveyed and sales completed would have purchased many certificates as we get for the sale of land. The lands are so proposed to be sold in two great quantities. It is very difficult to form a company for the purchase of a million acres. It ought to be sold in small quantities to make the sales more certain and numerous and consequently increase the public income. On this principle, it will be well to open a land office and grant the soil in such quantities as may suit the application. Now, here's the first mentioning of soil. Now, the granting of soil is something, I think that they mean land, not mineral rights. However, there were no mineral rights given. As a matter of fact, when a state became a state, everything was relinquished by the federal government. They could not hold back rights of minerals, rights of soil, or that would have been enumerated in the Constitution. Folks, this is exactly how, when we're going through the ratification debates currently with you, and so we'll get to those on Wednesday again with Tammy, because today and tomorrow we're doing this. So as we look through what they've been doing, doesn't mean they had the authority to make these claims on your mineral rights, soil, and so forth. And because they did this, the states never stepped on it.
And technically, there's not one state that I know of that has basically assumed mineral rights. So who owns the mineral rights of your land? Who really owns your land? You can go through a lot of processes to pay people to finally get your claim after you've paid it off. Legitimately, you own that land because there is no authority for anybody to be able to hold back that land because of some dubious deals with banks, deeds, and so forth, that you're only going to get a facade of a piece of paper, but you still really don't own that land. That's crap. They don't have the authority in the Constitution to do that. They may have assumed, and they're acting as bad actors without that authority, but that doesn't make it legitimate. So, anywho, and you know, I know there's a lot of people that, oh, you know, come on, he's stepping on my game, because I think there's people out there making money by trying to convince you that you need to go through this legal process, and I'll help you through it. I have not done this. I know a few people that have. I've never asked them, how much does that cost you to do that? Going into court, are you doing it all by yourself? Are you hiring a lawyer? Are you paying anybody? What the heck? The fact is, if it is not legitimate, then why are we wasting money on doing that? I think it's more important that we prove that these holdings or withholdings from us, regardless of how the federal government did it, they never had the authority granted. We never amended the Constitution to let them do it. It was all done on fraud. Just like, you know, the bankruptcies, the way the federal government has dealt with bankruptcies, they never had the authority to do what they did to settle those bankruptcies. So anyway, let me get back to this. Very expensive to the United States. Perhaps on inquiry we shall find the species. It has cost us to getting land surveyed and sales completed. Would have purchased as many as certain, let me see, a million acres. I've already read this part. It ought to be sold in small quantities to make the sales more certain and numerous and consequently increase the public income. On this principle, it will be well to open a land office and grant the soil in such quantities as may suit the application. I see this as granting the acreage of land, not that they're just saying soil. By this means, more may be expected for the purchase than when it is struck off at a wholesale price by the million acres. And on this way, the land office will be conducted without expense, which will be fixed on the purchaser, so that the whole money the lands may bring will come into the treasury without deduction. There are the considerations. So in other words, making everything done contingent on the sale, so that the surveyor doesn't get paid until the sale's done, so that everybody gets their money when the transaction happens, instead of having multiple transactions from, you know, the speculation, purchase, boom, boom, boom. And so got to remember that as long as this is a territory, Congress does have the ability to make the needful rules and regulations. Now, what happened as they started making states, if they really wanted to sell enough land in a state or in a territory that was going to become a state, then they needed to maintain that state as a territory to sell that land. Because once that state became a state, they no longer had any reachbacks into that state to be able to sell a parcel of land. And as a matter of fact, if they're going to maintain any land within that state, such as a fort, arsenal, magazine, dockyard, what have you, then as that state became a state, they would then go to that state and say, hey, you've got these arsenals, forts, magazines, and a dockyard or two, and we think we need to be able to support you by keeping the cavalry out there. And the state just said, no, we're okay. We're going to take that land, we're going to take those properties, and we're going to put our militia in there. And we're going to maintain and manage that with our militia. We don't need your help. Thank you. Because technically, the federal government had a responsibility of making sure that the territory was well configured within the militia, and they didn't do that. They basically created a self-licking ice cream cone. And they wanted to create several self-licking ice cream cones so that they could bring money into the coffers. So anyway, So by this means, more may be expected for the purchase than when it is struck off sale at a wholesale price by the Million Acres. And in this way, the land office will be conducted without expense, which will be fixed on the purchaser so that the whole money and lands may bring into the treasury without deduction. So I just finished reading that. There are other considerations why a land office should be opened for the sale of that territory in the way just mentioned. There are, at this moment, a great number of people on the ground who are willing to acquire by purchasing a right to the soil they are seated upon. Allured by this, by its fertility, the agreeableness of the climate, and the prospects of future ease to themselves and families, they would not seek a change. Kentucky already full, at least there are no more valuable lands to be got with a clear title. Can receive no more immigrants, they therefore turn their wishful eyes upon the lands of the Union. They hope to get them of Congress upon as good terms as they can procure themselves of the speculators. What will these men think who have placed themselves on a vacant spot, anxiously waiting in disposition by the government to find their preemption right engrossed by the purchaser of millions of acres? Will they expose themselves to be preyed upon by these men? They might submit to this, but they have other offers. There are 7,000 souls waiting for lands. They will have them here or elsewhere, but there is some danger if they cannot be accommodated within the boundaries of the United States. They will do one of two things: either move to the Spanish territory, where they're not altogether uninvited, and become an accession of a power to a foreign nation, forming to us a dangerous frontier, or they will take this course, move on to the United States territory, and take possession without your leave. What then will be the case? They will not pay. Okay, so if you think about it, if they go further out into the farther territories, they take the risk of dealing with the, you know, more hostility from the Indians, more problems, because they're really going to be out in the territory more on their own. But in those places, they had, I believe, this is where you could homestead. You could just go out and stake a claim. But within the territory where they basically are allocating all this for sale, this is one of the reasons why I think the drive here was to create this office so that they could capture the sale or the transfer of land while it was still under their stewardship before the state stepped in. Okay, so they will not pay you money. Will you then raise a force to drive them off? That has been tried. Troops were raised and sent under General Harmer to effect that purpose. They burnt the cabins, broke down the fences, and tore up the potato patches. But 3 hours after the troops were gone, these people returned again, repaired the damage, and are now settled upon the lands in open defiance of the authority of the Union. But nevertheless, they are willing to pay an equitable price for those lands, and if they may be indulged with a preemption to the purchase, no men will be better friends to the government. They went on the grounds with an intention of purchasing and are kept there by a hope that the government will see their interest and dispose of the land upon reasonable terms. But if you do not listen to their request, if you neglect or despise their offers, and they prove too weak to resist omnipotent arm of government, they will have recourse to a neighboring power for protection. Hopes of that protection are now held out to them. It is my duty to inform you of that fact. They will be led to think their interest is separate from yours on the Atlantic shores. It will take prudent management to prevent the fatal effects of commotion in that country. One of the most unhappy things we could do would be to refuse selling those lands in less quantities than by the million of acres. It would certainly be a cause of disgust. if not a separation, if the object was so to prevent the settlement of the country, it would be another thing, but that cannot be accomplished. It is not in the power of any force on earth to prevent the increase of the population now begun. It is therefore much better that we should incline them to friendship than oblige them to become our enemies. Now, this is kind of interesting that, you know, they're in this position of being able to open up immigration. Now, you got to be under, you know, when you look at the territories, the states have the ability to dictate who's going to immigrate. We've talked about this before. Immigration is not a federal responsibility. But when it came to the territories, they had that. See, and as long as the federal government had this territory, they were really playing in this ambiguous layer. However, the states, the state legislatures should have been watching them and should have been actually keeping them from assuming and diminishing the sovereignty and playing these games with the territory. Congress, I see the point that they need to make sure that they're transitioning these lands to good immigrants and that those immigrants become willing citizens of the Union. And as these territories grow and as they start joining the Union, then, you know, everybody gets happier and happier and happier. Anyway, let me just keep moving on here. The immigrants who reach the Western country will not stop until they find a place where they can securely seat themselves. Your lands first offer their fertility and agreeableness will tempt them to pitch there. But to secure them, they must have a well-grounded hope that the lands they cultivate may become their own. To encourage this, you must open that territory to them and let them have lands for pay. You must go further. You must open the land office in that country because it will be impossible for the indigenous persons to travel far. The indigent, the poor people, to be able to travel back to D.C., far for an office right. You can then establish a government among them and derive advantages from them, which are now totally lost. They wish for your government and laws and will be gratified by the indulgence, but they wish also to acquire property under them. They wish for your lands, and what good reason can be offered to warrant a denial? If they cannot get your land, they must go further and obtain it of foreigners who are desirous of them, at any rate, who will give them lands without pay. Though these observations are sufficient, no doubt, to evince the necessity of doing something with respect to the Western Territory and something different from what has hitherto been done. So they're obviously looking at doing something different. Now, I can understand when you look at a prospector going in and buying up 1 million acres and then going out there and on their own, you know, making it a huge money-making deal. This is how real estate and how building and housing developments has really transitioned into the new age today, where they're still making bank. I mean, you've heard me complain before that a real estate transaction where a real estate agent, everybody's got their finger in the property owner's pocket because the property owner is losing everything in selling their property, or I should say losing everything, but all the points come out of them. Typically, the buyer just buys whatever the cost is. The problem is whenever you sell, that's when title companies and real estate agents want their piece. This is why I have said in these days, I cannot understand why anybody would buy property through an agent. You're better off looking to see if you can buy, you know, privately and ensure that you're saving them money so that you can get the discounts of the cost of what came out of their pocket. It'd save you money. Now, when we're looking at a small percentage of a big number, it is still a big number, right? What is 7% on $100,000? $7,000. you know, you add that up by a million, that's $70,000. That could be an annual salary for somebody easily at the sale of one home. Now, the real estate agent doesn't make that, but they split that. They split that between the buying agent. I mean, everybody's got their fingers in the homeowner's pocket. Why would you do that? So as we look at how they started then, and this is how people, speculators, made money, and this is how people started getting rich. Whoever had excessive money was able to play these games. Now, I've been told, but the congressional records don't go into who does and who doesn't. These are just men coming up with the policies of how they could basically, I'll just say, frustrate the ability for people with money to come in and use their affluence to gain, you know, more financial gain and control, you know, over the growth of America. So I see what they're doing is good. But anyway, let me get back into this. In order that the committee may have a full view of my ideas, I will read the plan I have in my hand upon which a law may be founded. He here read a previous resolution to be followed by the plan, which was to this effect: resolved that it is the opinion of this committee that an act of Congress ought to pass for establishing and regulating a land office for the sale of vacant and unappropriated land in the Western Territory. And then parentheses here by way of separation resolutions followed in detail the constituent parts of this office and the routine in which the business should be conducted, directing the expense of the office to be supported by the fees payable before the warrants and patents are delivered. Mr. Benoit was well convinced of the importance of the subject, but did not think the committee ripe for a decision. The other departments were not established. Therefore, it was best to leave the resolution on this subject as much as at large as possible. He had no objection to an adoption of a general resolution and the appointment of a subcommittee to consider of and arrange the business, but he could not consent to limit it in manner the gentleman proposed. Perhaps the measure might interfere with the former arrangements, and it would be difficult, if not unjust, to alter them. Besides, the plan of the business was mere matter of experiment. More than necessity of such an establishment may be superseded by throwing the business into the hands of one of the three great departments which the House had agreed to organize. Now, the three great departments was the War Department, right? The Treasury and the State Department. They called them a little bit different. I mean, it wasn't the Department of Defense, War, Treasury, and I think Foreign Affairs. Anyway, for these reasons, he moved to amend the resolution by striking out the words "a land office," which would leave the subject at large. Mr. Lee seconded this motion. Mr. Vining took it, and the committee ought to carry this measure into effect as speedily as it was possible. He was convinced from what was said, what the gentleman near him, Mr. Scott, had said, that it was indispensably necessary that a land office should be established. He did not conceive the business could be engrafted upon either of the three grand departments. There must be an independent, unconnected office. And technically, this is not an executive. This is Congress's responsibility, established in the Western country, where the necessary communications may be made and the money can be secured to the officer of the Treasury. Why then should gentlemen combine objects which are distinct in their nature and throw the whole weight of this branch of government upon another already well burthened with businesses? Mr. Scott admitted his measure to be mere matter of experiment, but gentlemen ought not to object to it on that account, because it was an experiment that would cost nothing. The officers were to have nothing but fees for their services. Mr. Clymer did not believe the committee were prepared for a decision at this time. He considered the subject to be as intricate and difficult as it was interesting, and therefore hoped full time would be given for their investigation. Many persons had purchased large quantities of land of the late Congress with a view to sell them in small lots to accommodate the people who are inclined to settle upon them. If Congress now open a land office for the sale of small quantities, it will no doubt overcast the prospect of advantage which induced the former and may induce future purchasers to apply for large grants. These observations and others which would readily occur to every gentleman would satisfy the committee that they ought not to participate the business or precipitate the business. For this reason, they moved the rising of the committee. Mr. White opposed the rising of the committee for the reason suggested. He was confident, this is just going back through the how they're debating this. He was confident every member saw the propriety of doing something speedily in the business and hoped they would agree to the resolution as the best mode of disposing of the land and giving satisfaction to the people. Now Mr. Madison speaks up. Mr. Madison had no objection to the rising of the committee as the means of obtaining information, but he thought the business deserving of the earliest attention. The clear and full manner in which the gentleman from Pennsylvania had opened the subject to the view of the committee left no doubt on his mind of the propriety of taking some early measures to accomplish the business in the manner suggested by that gentleman. The facts and intelligence mentioned were too important to be passed lightly over. He should, for the present, agree to rise, but hope the subject would be resumed in the House. The question was taken on the first resolution removed by Mr. Scott and passed by the affirmative and the others remaining on the table. The committee then rose and reported progress. Mr. Gary then moved that a committee be appointed to consider the state and the unappropriated lands in the Western Territory and to report thereupon. Mr. Viney thought this motion contradictory to one just adopted in the committee. If time was necessary for obtaining information, it was useless to set a committee about the business because every gentleman might have easy access to all the former Congress had done on this subject, in other words, Continental Congress. Mr. Page disliked the appointment of a subcommittee on business which was before the whole and doubted if it was in order. Mr. Gary said it was in order. Or actually, Mr. Gary said it was of importance that the House should be made master of the subject, and he knew no way so likely to proceed in it as by appointing a subcommittee to consider and inquire in the state of those lands. He looked upon the proposition to be detached from what was just before the committee of the whole, yet it was of the nature as to reflect upon the light and upon the subject. He therefore hoped his motion would be agreed to. So obviously, they were struggling back and forth of what to really settle on at this point before they move forward. And so with that, we'll pick this up tomorrow as we dive more into this creating of this land, this Western lands, and the Home Department. I'm G.R. Mobley. We're Reclaiming the Republic, and we need your help. God bless.
If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review as well as my description of the republic review model on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how republic review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you.